Hi, folks, and thanks for listening to this Reboot Republic podcast. A couple of things before we kick off. First of all, I need to draw your attention to the link at the bottom of the podcast. It is for Dignity for Palestine. If you heard the latest podcast, Dr. Musallam joined us and spoke about the work that the volunteers are doing there to maintain health and support services to people in Nusrat and throughout Gaza. And we have a route to help them. So if you can, click that link and throw them a few quid. I can assure you their work is essential and your support is needed now more than ever. I also awkwardly have to ask you to help us keep going. The Tortoise Shack has no ads, has no sponsors, and while the podcast is free, it doesn't mean it has no value. If you like what we do and you want to see it keep going, please support it. Make May the month you join us by clicking on the link at the top of the podcast. It says patreon.com/tortoiseshack. It is the price of a cheap pint to you, but to us it literally is mics on, lights on, and bills paid. And you'll be helping us carve out the space that we need to continue to do this type of work. Thanks for your support. Thanks for listening. I'd love to see you over on the Patreon. Enjoy the show.
Welcome to Reboot Republic, the podcast that goes behind the headlines and looks at the big issues in this republic of inequality. We are the podcast of solutions and the podcast of hope. And I'm your host, Rory Hearn. And I'm delighted to be joined on the podcast by a former colleague of mine and someone who is I've really, really looked up to. And for many, many years, it's Professor John Sweeney from Maynooth University, and who also people will, I'm sure, know as someone who's on the media a lot and an expert, global expert on climate change. John, I'm delighted to have you back on Reboot Republic.
Delighted to be here, Rory.
And John, just maybe to start with, in terms of the at a global level, maybe you could just give us a sense of where are we at in terms of climate change, what's happening. Just to give us your sense of where are we at now, right now. But I suppose the climate itself, but also politically.
Well, I think people will be familiar with the sort of the usual stories that come out of institutions like Copernicus, the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, the IPCC. And to some extent, you know, people get fatigued by hearing the same message over and over again. But I think it is important that the reality of what confronts us and what confronts the futures of our children, our grandchildren, is constantly put in front of people, because the decisions that are made today are just so important for them. The most recent report, I think, came a week or two ago from Copernicus, which kind of confirmed that we were warming more quickly than perhaps we anticipated from the various models that we've run in the past. I mean, it told us that Europe, for example, is warming twice as quick as most of the world. It told us that we're above in Europe that critical 2-degree threshold where we're worried about tipping points that may not be recoverable from. And it told us that, Europe last year, for example, had the biggest wildfire it ever experienced, where an area the size, in fact, 50% bigger than the area of County Dublin, was burned, destroyed by a wildfire. And it told us about the wetter conditions that Europe experienced last year, as well as the heat waves that we've now largely forgotten about that occurred last summer. And all of this is really telling us that, you know, when we talk about climate change, we're not talking about the future. Mm. We're talking about something that's happening now. Yeah. We're talking about something that we have to adapt to very, very quickly indeed before it becomes, if you like, an insurmountable problem for the people that come after us.
Yeah, absolutely. And even people were talking about, you know, this year in Ireland, for example, being one of the wettest years we've had in a long time.
Yeah, I mean, we know that Ireland is 7% wetter than it was 30 years ago. We know it's just under a degree warmer than it was 30 years ago. And what we really do know, though, is that, you know, the harbingers of what's to come are manifested first in terms of changing extremes. And, we've challenged our own temperature extreme record in the past few years. We've We've noticed the extreme wetness that our winters are now displaying. This last winter, of course, we had a wet winter followed by a wet spring. And this is giving all sorts of problems for our agriculturalists. It will cause problems in the other direction in the future in terms of summers that we expect to be drier, which will cause problems for water supply. And we can talk about that, if you like, a little later on, because I think that's going to be a major issue for many people in the east of Ireland in particular in the years to come. So, yeah, all of this is really saying to us that, you know, what we talked about 20 years ago in the early models are now happening. I have mixed feelings about that because, you know, I was the person that did the first models of Irish climate. I was responsible for the early models. And while there's a professional satisfaction in seeing some of those predictions come true, I think there's also a really sense of despair that the action wasn't taken 20 years ago and 10 years ago and 5 years ago that would have perhaps helped to position Ireland better in the future to cope with what's coming down the line. So all of that is saying, I think, that, you know, we don't talk about climate and we don't talk about it politically. We've seen the logjam at UNFCCC level at the COPs, where the requirement for unanimity among 200 nations, almost 200 nations, has bedeviled progress over the past 30 years now in terms of tackling this problem. And we've seen the politicians go very, very, very quiet in Ireland over this issue in the past few months as an election approaches, scared, terribly scared of losing a few votes in return for really standing up and being counted in terms of safeguarding the future. And this is something which I am quite annoyed about, that we elect people, politicians, to take the hard decisions, to take the strategic long-term view, to put short-termism on the back burner when it comes to major issues. And we're just not seeing that among any of the major political parties at all at the moment.
And if we go into that a little bit, because that kind of is, in many ways, I think anyway, the biggest challenge to making the changes that are needed is what is happening politically and what is possibly going to happen in terms of, for example, our own general election here, but, you know, general election coming up in many countries. It is the year of elections and we will have the European elections as well in June. In terms of how you think politically we can reshape that and try and win back support for major change on climate action. For me, I think, and I think you'd share this view, but I'd be interested to get your response on it. We haven't put, our policies haven't put questions of social justice central to the transition. And the sense and feeling from people is that they are being made to do all these changes and introduce taxes and etc. Whereas the big boys, the billionaires, the whoever, you know, the corporations, they kind of keep going on business as usual. And there is an element of truth to that. And the positive wins that could be happened, that could be happening, for example, you know, major retrofitting of homes, the changing of our whole economy to value, you know, care occupations, to give people a decent income, that it's like just that sense that we haven't put social justice centrally enough to the green transition and green agenda. What would you think about that?
I think it's fair. I mean, I think there are two elements to this. And the first is, you're right. I think there's an element of, I suppose, the lack of leadership, which is central to this issue. And that lack of leadership stems from short-termism. It stems really from the electoral cycle being more important than the next generation. But secondly, I think there's also an element of, well, there's an element of misinformation, which is really important as well, whereby people are fed the wrong information and they're told what they wanted to hear, which is, this is no problem, it will go away. And they buy, there's a natural instinct for people to buy that kind of sentiment. But there is also a failure of getting the message across that what we're talking about here has social justice embedded in it, that the transition, for example, in energy will make cleaner air, it will make warmer homes, it will enable people to enjoy a better quality of life. It will enable them to be ultimately more financially secure. You know, the taxpayer at the moment is spending 5 to 8 billion euros a year importing fossil fuels from Arab sheikhs and Russian oligarchs. And you know, that's something which would go a long way towards social justice here in Ireland. It would go a long way towards easing the transition and making the just transition something that's meaningful and something that would help people. So I think, you know, getting the message across that retrofitted homes are warmer, they're drier, they're more comfortable, they will improve wellness, they will improve health. 1,000 people in Ireland die each year from the effects of fossil fuels, from air pollution associated with fossil fuels. We don't get that message across like we do. So I think there's a combination of factors here. It's messaging, but it's political leadership. It's, if you like, negating the misinformation that some quarters are so intent on selling to the public. And we see that with a lot of greenwashing. You know, you only have to turn on your television to hear the kind of greenwashing that goes around in terms of sales of products, where you can, I think the Irish public can see through that quite quickly. But it's something that we have to tackle to try and stop the message being distorted in the way it is. Now, I think as well, of course, you know, we have to recognise that, you know, making the transition will have high upfront costs. And that's where we have to look at where we can save money in some areas. But certainly, you know, there's huge economic opportunities from positioning Ireland as somebody in the forefront of this transition. We've seen other countries steal a march on us in terms of renewable energy. We've seen countries steal a march on us in terms of retrofitting, in terms of electric vehicles and so on. So all of these things which we're doing.
The thought that comes to mind, John, right? And not the thought, but something that, you know, I've seen within, you know, climate policy and you know, it's been advocated and talked about, and you'll be familiar with this, you know, the community energy generation model. The idea that as we develop renewable energy, that electricity costs for people should fall, because it is essentially a form of course, you have to pay for the infrastructure, you have to, a form of free energy generation. And as you say, that 6 billion, you know, we're spending on fossil fuels, the reduction, that we're not developing renewable energy in a way that the benefits are going to people, that they feel a reduction in the cost, that it's the same privatized model, market delivery model. And it's so, like, for example, if we were rolling out the wind farms and the, you know, the other forms of renewable, the solar farms on a public basis, and even, you know, whatever, you know, paying some private contractors to do it, but it's publicly controlled and that energy was directly put into reducing, like really reducing, like halving, you know, reducing by 50-60% energy bills, then you would see a massive, you know, people go, okay, this is why we need to do this. But it's not being done that way.
No, it's not. And I think you're seeing the power of vested interests at work here. You know, it's we simply have never developed the engineering skills, developed the skills necessary through our education system in many ways to provide those kinds of, community-based developments that I think would be important. But we haven't seen community gain to the extent that we should have from these large renewable energy systems. And of course, it's a question of getting things done quickly and getting things done in a time scale that, you know, we haven't got a lot of time left to do it. But yes, I think it's a legitimate statement to make that had we to do this again, we should have done it with a more community-based buy-in from the word go. You just need to look around the ownership of many of these large wind farms and solar farms to see that once again Ireland has simply just passed on the issue to benefit shareholders in other countries in many cases. So it's unfortunate, but we, as they say, we are where we are. We have to do it quickly now because we haven't.
Yeah, I think, you know, when we're talking about politically, the thing we need to change is these things really matter because people pick those up and then they run with it. And then it's like, this is the thing that's used to stop the other progress. And I think they seem small things. And I just think we need to think much more quickly and much more radically about, you know, the new wind farms that are going up, the new solar farms. Just as it comes to, do you have a view on the data centers?
Yeah, I think once again, we're kowtowing to very powerful vested interests there. You know, there's no point in us sort of building renewable energy systems where 30 or 40% of our total electricity demand will go to data centers, which have very limited employment, very limited benefits to society. And what really is annoying me at the moment is the way in which data centers are getting around the restrictions imposed on them as regards connection to the grid by building their own gas-fired stations. And that is something which undermines our decarbonisation efforts at a national scale. So I think, you know, there's been a kind of a moratorium on data centres around the Dublin region, but they're still thriving. And we're going to hit 100 data centres in Ireland very shortly. And that will have huge demand on our electricity demand, which will negate a lot of the expansion of electricity generation that we're now making from renewable sources. So I think we have to relook at those and we have to ask questions in terms of cost benefit to Irish society, in terms of employment. And while it is useful to have those high-tech centres in Ireland close to the headquarters of many of the computer firms themselves, and the internet firms in particular, then I think the cost benefit for us is marginal. Of course, they're coming because it suits them to come to a climate which is very equitable and where you don't need to have high air conditioning costs during the summertime, for example. But unless we can somehow or other siphon off the excess energy, the excess heat from data centres and put it to community use or give it to the community free, then I don't think we should look at the unfettered expansion of them.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, the moratorium should be extended across the country at this point.
Yeah, yep. I mean, if we're going to have a national grid, then national grid restrictions apply everywhere, not just in regions of high consumption like the East.
Yeah. And I think as well, it's important to say that, like, you know, we have this idea that renewable energy generation is infinite, but it is finite as well in terms of how many, you know, how many solar farms you can build, how much wind farms you develop.
It is. And, you know, we have ambitions to export renewable energy, excess renewable energy on a Europe grid. We also have ambitions to use excess renewable energy to generate hydrogen, which I think is a very positive ambition down the road because it will enable the very hard to decarbonize sectors such as aviation and some transport sectors to be provided with a renewable source. So giving all that excess energy away for a low return in data centers to me doesn't make a lot of sense.
Yeah, yeah. You wanted to talk about carbon budgets.
Yeah, I mean, I was so excited 3 years ago when we managed finally to pass the Climate Act. Mm. And within that Climate Act, which was the culmination of, I suppose, the program for government, which originally said we would be decreasing our emissions by 7% per year till 2030. That was the commitment made. And then the Climate Act, I suppose, formalized that in two very sensible ways. One was the establishment of the two carbon budgets for 21 to 25 and for 26 to 30. And secondly, the advice of the Climate Change Advisory Council in formulating those budgets and in constraining to some extent the minister from deviating from them. I've seen, however, that the carbon budgets have been largely ignored by our political masters, and that now we are kind of accepting that we are going to breach those legally binding limits, firstly in 21 to 25 by quite a substantial amount.
So just briefly explain for listeners, what are the carbon budgets?
Well, the carbon budget's rather like your household budget, where you have so much to spend, and if you go beyond that, you're in debt. And the carbon budget reflects the fact that the world as a whole has a dwindling carbon budget because carbon stays in the atmosphere for centuries. So once you use up a certain amount, you have, if you like, put yourself on a road to climate change, which you can't come back from. And within Ireland, we have, you know, there's a big scramble globally to claim shares of that dwindling budget for countries.
Yeah.
We in Ireland have claimed more than our fair share, given our historical emissions. But it is, if you like, a straightforward budget where you are constrained to organise your economy to live within it. Just like in your household budget, you control your spending and income to live within your own household budget. In Ireland, we had a budget of 295 million tonnes for the first of those periods, and I think 200 for the second or so. But what is important here, and this is the crunch that hasn't really been accepted, is just like your household budget, if you exceed it and go into overdraft, you have to pay it back in the next period. And that applies also in the carbon budget. So if we exceed our carbon budget, as it's set at the moment, several or 5 million tons of carbon equivalent, then it has to come out of the next five-year period, 2026 to 2030. And we're currently projected to be exceeding that as well. And that means really problems down the line for people in the next 5 to 10 years, because those will be legally mandatory figures that have to be complied with. So we will have to take really radical decisions in transport, in agriculture. If we don't take those decisions now, it means...
And how much are we going to overshoot?
Well, provisional estimates our EU limits will be that we'll overshoot by about 3.72 million tonnes by 2030 compared to 2018. But, you know, that's the EU values. But for our own carbon budgets, we're going to exceed that by slightly more. And what's critical here is that, you know, if we're finding it hard to do now, we're going to find it very, very difficult to do in the next 5 years, and we're going to find it almost impossible to do after 2030.
Can I come in for a brief moment, Professor Sweeney? Only yesterday, Fianna Fáil's Lisa Chambers, who was a candidate for the MEP Parliament, said offshore wind has the potential to green the country and fuel agriculture, industry and homes with green sustainable energy. We don't need to worry about curtailing our agricultural sector. We're good at farming and we keep farming. Now, how disappointing is that to hear from a main party in the coalition government when you just put that in, based on the last 6-7 minutes of what you've said, how disappointing is to hear that that is the direction of travel currently?
Well, it kind of exemplifies what I've been saying about an unwillingness to stand up and be counted in terms of the sort of long-term view of things. Our agricultural sector emits 38% of our total national emissions. We can't achieve the carbon budgets that we're legally mandated to do without significant reductions in agriculture. And, I think while agriculture is making some useful reductions at the moment, they're nothing like what is necessary to make a contribution to achieving those reductions that we will be required to do. The taxpayer throws an awful lot of money at agriculture. There is a social contract here where 70% of agricultural income comes from the taxpayer. So, I think we have to expect that agriculture will play its part in the national strategy. We haven't seen evidence of that happening. We've seen, sadly, an extra 500,000 cattle being put onto the land in the last decade or so, and we've seen agricultural emissions going in the wrong direction. Now, I think we're beginning to see that peak a little and come down, but it needs to come down more quickly. It needs to come down more radically than it does at the moment for a number of reasons. And one of those reasons, of course, is that we are now, if you like, trashing our water resources, which is something that I don't think society really wants to see happen. And I think there's no dubiety about the causes of water pollution and the decline in quality of our rivers and lakes and coastal habitats over the past decade as being primarily due to runoff from agricultural sources. So I have a great deal of respect for farmers. I think they are great custodians of the landscape in general. I think that we have to foster them and we have to encourage them. But at the same time, I think they have been led into policy cul-de-sacs by being told that the way ahead is to go from 80 cows to 120 cows and so on, and by intensification based on constantly feeding their grass supplies with nitrate fertilizer. And I don't think that's the way ahead for either the image of Ireland from a tourist point of view, from an environmental point of view. The clean green island could well be the first casualty of a realization by the international community that Ireland is not the clean green Ireland anymore. And I'd hate
so what do you think needs to be done practically, John, on it?
Practically, I think we have to change our agricultural system, become more diverse, become a system which is not dependent on a nitrates derogation, which seems to have been the assumption that has pervaded agricultural planning in the past decade. I think we have to become a country.
And to be very clear, sorry, just before you go on to the nitrates derogation is in relation to essentially the fertilizer that is spread on the land and the amount which is and the amount that is required to produce the level of grass that we produce.
That's right. I mean, we grow perennial ryegrass. Perennial ryegrass is not particularly a native species to Ireland. And without feeding perennial ryegrass with fertilizers, it doesn't grow that well. And we've had the enjoyment of a derogation from the rate at which nitrates can be spread on the land for many years now, which is coming to an end. We will, after the end of next year, be the only country in Europe which will have sought a nitrates derogation. Denmark, which has been the other country using it, has decided this summer that it will not reapply for a nitrates derogation. We are putting all our eggs in one basket in terms of holding on to an admittedly lower level of nitrates, but one which will still require a derogation from the directive. So that puts us in a rather unusual position where we're the only country saying to the Commission, look, we're a special case. We want to continue to pour nitrates onto our grassland in excess of what the Commission is saying is advisable to do so. And I think we have to look as well, not just at the pollution of our rivers and lakes and coastal environments. The coastal environments are a bit neglected here, but we have also to look at the potential health effects. There are some interesting studies coming out of Denmark which suggests that people in areas which have even relatively low nitrate concentrations in their drinking water are having adverse health effects in terms of particular cancer types. So I think we have to really radically question the model of intensification that we're currently advocating for Irish agriculture. And that's just part of the solution to achieving our carbon budgets. The other part, and let's not forget it, is the part which deals with transport.
Yeah. Here,
more so than agriculture, we have failed. Here, we have increased our transport emissions, not by small amounts, even which agriculture would say they do, but by 130%. And that's
since when?
I think since 1990, 130, maybe even 160% higher now.
Yeah.
But it's simply a reflection of the way in which we've become wedded to our cars and become a car-borne society. One interesting statistic I found was that the average Irish car travels twice as much in a year as the average German car. Mm. And you know, that's a reflection, firstly, of our dispersed population, our failure to put in place a good public transport system, but also, I think, a psychological attachment whereby we think every individual should have a car.
And on the public transport, because that is very, very important. And again, you know, it is something that the state has a key role in doing, is, you know, providing that public transport. And it does also link back, as you say, to our, you know, the design and development of our housing system as well, and these long, you know, large, sprawling, developer-led estates around suburbs, and the failure to develop, you know, low-rise, high-density, sustainable, affordable housing in our town centres and in our village centres and in our cities. In terms of transport, you know, the big push is EV, but a lot of people, most people, can't afford an EV. I can't afford an EV. So, you know, what do you think needs to happen around transport?
Well, I think we've been making some progress there. I think in particular, the reduction in transport fares, especially for young people, has been a sort of an eye-opener as to just what can be done to encourage more people to use public transport. And there are many places which have good public transport cities, but they're all in our urban areas. And, you know, I think we should progress that concept of making public transport more affordable, first and foremost, to try and get people out of their cars. And at the same time, make it, you know, that's the hard thing to do, make it relatively unhelpful for people to take their cars into the centre of a city and park there all day. I've avoided doing that for many years now. But I think it's something that we have to look at in terms of corporate bodies that still provide free parking, for example, for their employees. But on a wider scale, EVs will come down in price. They are penetrating the market in Ireland very, very quickly. And they have huge benefits in terms of cost. I mean, You're right in that they are expensive at the moment, but I think you have to factor in that the running costs are extremely low. I've had an EV for 3 years now, haven't taken it to a garage once. I'm not facing any servicing costs. I charge it overnight from 2 to 4 in the morning. It's peanuts compared to petrol costs and diesel costs, which I formerly had. Now, I think as the capital costs of buying an EV comes down, people will recognise these advantages. And of course, we also have to improve the charging infrastructure around the country to make so-called range anxiety a thing of the past, which batteries are improving to the extent that I think this will become a reality for many people. It won't necessarily help our congestion in the cities if we all have EVs, of course. So that does mean that we do have to try still and encourage active travel and encourage public transport development. And I think in particular here, rural Ireland is of course the bastion of the diesel and the petrol car. But if you think about it, you know, having a home charger in rural Ireland gives you enormous advantages. It's just as good as having an urban charger in your home in many of the towns and cities. So I think rural Ireland will also come to recognise the advantages of EV transport as well.
But so, John, I'll push you a little bit on this, yeah. Okay? Because there is a whole load of people out there who can't afford additional cost of anything, like are really struggling. And I'm talking like hundreds of thousands, millions of people actually in this country. The deprivation rate is now heading towards a fifth of the population. They can't afford, many of them can't afford one car, not to mind an EV car. They are spread across rural Ireland. They are spread across our towns and cities. And I think that this feels, and I'll tell you how it feels for me, you know, and I'm an academic, and that I'm not doing enough because I can't afford the car. And you put people who are living in poverty and being told, you know, the EV cars are coming, you know, you need to make your change for the environment, and they go back, you know, just the green agenda can go get, put it in the bin and use all that choice language. And I think we have to be really careful about how we speak to people and how, again, that issue of social justice and inequality is so pervasive and is so real that the idea that an EV car and, you know, some progress around public transport will be enough, that it's not. As you talk, and you talk about, and you know, the radical change around public transport and around that in particular, like in rural areas, but connecting is needed, and so much more investment is needed so that people don't feel, oh, this is my fault, or I'm just completely outside of this. I can't be part of this.
No, you're right. I mean, let's not climate shame people. Yeah. I mean, we shouldn't do it for the person that takes the odd flight for their annual two-week holiday, for example. And we shouldn't do it for people who don't feel able to get electrified, if you like, in transport in rural Ireland. I think, you know, it's a combination of things. I mean, we do have to offer subsidies to people to make the change, which are not enough at the moment. We do have to try and give them the alternatives of improved public transport, especially in rural Ireland, which is certainly deficient at the moment as well. But really, you know, down the road, you know, this is a whole of society change we have to make. Now, we have to bring people with us on this one. We have to recognize the problems of social inequality, but those problems are pervasive problems in many areas apart from transport. Rural people will find it difficult, poor people will find it difficult to afford many things in at present, but that's not an excuse for doing the right thing. We have to still provide the environment, provide the conditions whereby we can bring people of all, if you like, of all economic statuses with us. And that's a political problem as well.
It is,
You don't solve it by saying, I'm not going to take part in the future, I'm going to wash my hands of it. So again, it's leadership that's required and a sensitization to the realities of people who are not as well, if you like, economically able to join the transition as others. And they're the people that Just Transition has to look after.
Absolutely, absolutely. Just a last question, John. At a European level, what do you think the European Union should do? We're heading into European elections. What do you think MEPs should be, and prospective MEPs should be pushing on and pushing for?
Well, I've been very disappointed. I mean, I think the last month has been the most disappointing period for people concerned with the environment in terms of what Europe has been up to. We always rely on the Commission to put backbone into our own local politicians, to give them an excuse to do the right thing when they're dithering. And what I've seen in the past month has been really quite disconcerting. We've seen the Nature Restoration Law effectively sidelined at council level. After going through all of the hoops and all of the debates and being watered down significantly, being pulled at the last minute. But then even more surprisingly, we've seen the Parliament defining the Common Agricultural Policy. And we've seen many aspects of that policy at the last minute being changed, aspects like soil erosion, aspects like crop rotation, aspects like leaving fields fallow, all of those good things suddenly being dropped. And then even more recently, we've seen the Commission itself produce a 5-year strategic agenda, which it is required to do, which is all about bullets and business, effectively, and where sustainability, climate, environment hardly gets a mention, unlike 5 years ago when it was really at the top of the agenda. And that is something which I'm really annoyed about. And of course, it's all done for political reasons rather than for proper environmental or social reasons. It's done to aid people who want to be elected. And I think the Commission, in that case, it's done to help von der Leyen achieve a second term. In terms of the Parliament, they're scared of the elections coming up for their re-election. And in terms of the Council, of course, many countries are facing into an electoral cycle, including our own. And all of that has conspired to really undermine a lot of the progress that was made in Europe over the past 5 years. And I'm quite disappointed that the Commission in particular have caved in effectively on these matters.
But what does that say to you that in order to, as you say, politically they're doing it because of the elections that are coming up, therefore they are bending to a certain political narrative that is anti-climate and anti the changes, the transition. So what does that tell you about what's going on?
Well, it tells me that powerful vested interest groups have an inordinately disproportionate influence on decision-making in Europe, just as they do here in Ireland. It tells me that there's a David and Goliath relationship here between, for example, civil society and interest groups, economic and other interest groups. And it tells me that politicians are very receptive to doing things which will not rock the boat at critical times for them, and that they will then listen to those that have influence, those that have the power, rather than the electorate. And they will not really alert the electorate to the fact that what we're doing is short-term influences, but not long-term interests in your interest. And that is, I think, of concern for the future, because if that's the way we're going, where it's the trolls on Twitter, whether it's the extreme right-wing misinformation campaigns that we see about immigration, whether it's the sort of the mantra that we can build houses everywhere, even if we haven't got a water supply for them, which I never touched on.
Yeah.
But those are the things which I think will come home to roost for us in the years ahead, unfortunately.
Yeah. Well, listen, John, thank you so much for giving your time. Excellent as always and far reaching in your analysis. And listen, you're, as you say yourself, you're well in your retirement, but actually still working as hard as ever. And we really appreciate all the work you're doing on it. It's fantastic. Thank you.
Thanks, Rory.
And thank you so much to our listeners as well. As always, for tuning in and for taking the time to listen. We really appreciate you. And please, if you can, share the podcast around. Let people know you're listening. Share it on social media. Send us in any feedback you have. And as always, we are independent media produced by Echo Chamber, Tony Groves of Echo Chamber. If you can, please become a patron. Support this podcast to keep going. Go over to patreon.com/tortoiseshack. And we will see you all very, very soon.